all of our organs, you know, are potentially speaking to us. And so in Visceribus Christi, takes the phrase, the bowels of Christ, and follows it from the Old Testament, where, of course, it's the bowels of, but not the bowels of Christ, through. And take my effort is to take it seriously and to look at its impact on counseling in two different ways. This, it involves a sort of a descent. And so what we're going to be doing is sort of starting here and moving down, and then tomorrow starting at the diaphragm and moving further. But my almost primary reason for bringing it here is to focus on what our capacities are as counselors to experience not our own, but someone else's visceral reactions. So that's where I'm actually going. Rescue. So I decided to use this introduction about the earthquake in Turkey. A lone survivor was pulled earlier this year from the ruins of the destroyed city, and at that point they'd already recovered 40,000 bodies, and it was gruesome. A journalist was asking her as she was being carted off how she survived, and she said, "I had nothing with me. I just tried to pass the time." In Greek, the word for to save actually has multiple meanings. You may know this: to rescue and to heal or to deliver. So what I want to suggest here is that from the very first time that God asked, "Where are you?" that question is either silly, because it's God and he knows exactly where they were, or rhetorical, which I don't think it was. I think it was a soulful question, because a shift had occurred in them. And it was a question that we might say they themselves could not answer, right? The shift that had just occurred in them is probably not something they could explain. But rescue operations, we might say, had begun as soon as God says, "Where are you?" and invites us to figure that out. We have a rescue operation. We help our clients dig out parts of themselves that are viscerally buried. That's the metaphor here. So here I'm mentioning something that I mentioned just at the other question-answers session. God said, "In the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." What exactly changed? And what I was explaining earlier is that what we read, if we take that to be what death meant, then what happened is Adam and Eve were suddenly split. We say they're mentally beside themselves, which in modern parlance means insanity, right? But so that's why I would call it potentially original dissociation, not traumatic dissociation, but original dissociation. Their bodies turned into objects of observation, and their minds able to go anywhere. Remember, their minds were able to imagine that if they ate that fruit, they would be like God. That's pretty lofty. Our minds can take us there, but it's a lie. So I'm drawing a distinction now, because as we know, in clinical work, dissociation tends to be, we would say, a more rare and extreme reaction, and that most of what we do doesn't involve at least that dramatic, complete dissociation. Instead, what we have with our clients is that will arise from traumatic losses or dire threats to our life. But burying parts of ourself creates, you might say, an inner distance. We're not completely separated from our body, but we try to create space in ourselves between our emotions and our awareness. So consider the following: that when inhibiting or suppressing an emotion until it is no longer felt, we can call it forgotten. Okay. Consider that Stoicism was a studied application of that principle, right? Almost a philosophy of trying to distance oneself from suffering. And so, in fact, is Buddhism from one perspective. Consider rationalistic critique of Romanticism. So the one of the things that C.S. Lewis deals with in The Abolition of Man, he starts it with a story of people standing in front of a waterfall, and one says, "It is sublime," and the other says, "It's pretty." And then what develops is from a school textbook in Britain, and what he's observing is that the people who wrote the textbook are teaching children that it's silly to say something is sublime. They're really only speaking of their emotions. If they say something sublime, you're just describing your emotion. You're not describing the waterfall. And what C.S. Lewis is saying, if you follow that logic all the way down, our emotions don't tell us the truth about anything anymore, right? It divorces us from the world. It's no longer an organ of perception. And then the theological critiques, sometimes, of enthusiasm. I was listening to a lecture by a respected, I'm just going to say theologian, I won't even characterize them beyond that, from a respected university, who was describing mystical union, our union with Christ, and he said, not that we're talking about enthusiasm. So in other words, not that anybody would get excited about this, not that anybody would focus on actual experience. That's a worry. So all of these things are ways of sort of distancing ourselves, systematically in some cases, even as Christians, from our emotions. So, interoception in the chest. Interoception, I just want to define, is roughly internal awareness of the body. It's a field of experience that is, I think, potentially pivotal to therapeutic processes. And I think, in fact, that if somebody were really a strict cognitivist, if they truly adhered to that and paid no attention to the information that's coming from the body, they would be a very, very poor therapist. But in fact, so many different approaches fall under one title, like cognitive, that doesn't apply. I would say that our ability to have that awareness is accessible by common grace, meaning that great non-Christian therapists and counselors certainly use it, access it. In, again, The Abolition of Man, Lewis's warning was that these school books that he started with, the textbooks, might be systematically cultivating people without chests. He was writing before men didn't mean men and women, okay? So he just says men without chests. More than a metaphor, this means that I want to argue here that we are viscerally designed for relationships. So just like we can stand in front of a waterfall and say it's sublime, and that says something about the waterfall, we can sit in front of our client and have an experience that says something about our client. So I say interoception is the voice or the cry or the signal that the client and counselor are following when on a therapeutic rescue mission, in the same way that people were using listening for voices in the rubble, right? We're listening to what a person is capable of experiencing, willing to experience also at any point in time. Yes. This is a technical definition of interoception, an umbrella term for the potentially conscious sum of all processes by which the brain receives sensory input from different bodily systems. Okay, so this is technical as well, but it does speak of the neurological basis of interoception in the viscera. Viscera are all the parts of ourselves that are inside a cavity. So that includes the abdominal cavity, the chest cavity, and also the cranium. Technically our brain is part of the viscera. But in practical usage, it's not referred to that way, okay? So when we say visceral, we usually are referring to what we can experience here. Interoceptive resonance, then, somebody asked me about earlier, but I deferred. If and when it occurs, I'm at the second paragraph. If and when it occurs, it refers to the more or less accurate mirroring of another interoceptive experience, regardless of the degree to which the other is conscious of or willing to acknowledge the experience. Now, if you actually understand, if I don't know how clear that is, but I have a lot packed into that. What's implied is it comes from my experience, and it was happening to me mid-career. I would drive into work. I had a lovely drive, you know, terrain therapy. Got to the city, usually often in a good, very good state. I would have clients scheduled at 9, 10, and 11. And by the time by the time noon had come, I had had a headache with my 9 o'clock client, a stomach ache with my 10 o'clock client, right? And this feeling of pressure in my chest with my 11 o'clock client. And what I was gradually realizing is this has nothing to do with me. For a while, I was just thinking, what's going on with me, right? And when a breakthrough occurred in my career, when I realized I was getting important information about my clients every single hour. And what was interesting, of course, I had to test that theory. And this is where the first paragraph comes in. There, my client's self-report is primary. I would have never gotten anywhere if I hadn't been able to ask a client, so how are you doing? Can we just do a physical check-in? How are you doing right now physically? And I found out that what I was experiencing was exactly what they were experiencing. Often enough that I realized I can rely on this. This is as good as anything I've got, right? It's as good as my reasoning process or better. Once I got that, then I was able to realize that sometimes I was experiencing something that they would not acknowledge that they were experiencing, and that did not mean that I was mistaken. They're buried. So mirror neurons, there's a neurological basis for this. I was sitting with somebody the other day who wanted to talk with me. And by the time I'd been with him listening for about 20 minutes, I was mirroring his posture and my neck was getting so sore. And I was literally thinking to myself, I don't know how much longer I can take this. I need to get out. I need to disconnect from this conversation so that I can take care of my neck, right? But eventually I mentioned it to him. And the breakthrough in that little session was that by the end of it, he discovered what all of that was about, which was a definite history of just very painful childhood history. And what he was able to do, it was very difficult, you know, for me. I said, can I just touch you, you know? And I tried to give him something, a guide down his backbone, right? And he just, at one point, I could tell his body could not respond. And then all of a sudden, bing. And I looked at him and I thought, I'm looking at the boy now. His body somehow, it was still there, the possibility, right? And he found it. And he said, I haven't felt like this. I haven't felt my arm like this, you know, in such a long time. So you have enough experiences like this, you start to trust it and you start to realize it's the shortcut. As you sometimes start to wonder, do I need words at all? Could I do psychotherapy without words? So, and I also think it's there's a book that could be read if you were interested in that, and also I think it's the taproot of genuine empathy. If somebody says something and it's sad and I say, yeah, I empathize with that, that's not empathy, right? Because a computer-generated therapist could do that. What's empathy is if I actually can viscerally experience what a client is experiencing. the harmonics of dialogue. So now I want to describe what often happens. I've been describing what can happen. In real dialogue, we're focused on other things, which is why it took me a while till mid-career to get to the point I just described. Because when I'm trained to talk, and I'm trained to listen, and I'm trained to focus on words and transcripts of conversations, right? And nowadays, people are doing the same thing with text therapy, totally focused on words, maybe a few emojis sprinkled in there. That's not interoception, okay? A very left brain scholastic process turned me into a psychologist. And even our diagnostic categories that I spent so much, and our psychological testing, verbal, right? So Rorschach, a little different, you know, the projectives. So we were trying to get deeper. And then we have everything that's involved with our records and our legal implications, all words. And we can get quite tied up in this. And very clever therapists might just be stuck here. Then we have theories, which I call words about words. Now we learn to have theories about words, so we can even read somebody's transcript, you know, and have a theory about what's going on with them. Interpret a dream of somebody that we've never met, you know, all this silliness. So you have this enlarged, but you do have this enlarged hermeneutic, because when we listen to somebody, we unless we're just going to stay on the very level that they're coming to us with, so they present a problem and we say, okay, that's it, that's the presenting problem, and we assume that they know exactly what their problem is, well, then they're a very lucky client if they came in with the correctly identifying their problem, right? Because I'm a therapist who has no capacity to listen and with depth to that. But in fact, theories do allow us to listen with depth, and that's part of what I was trying to present yesterday in the God-shaped vacuum, a geometry of longings, is a model for listening. But this level, it depends. Think of a good psychoanalyst. I was also trained by a Jungian for a while. So I was a member of the International Association of Relational Psychodynamic Psychotherapists. So that was another layer in there, right? But that when you're doing that kind of therapy, it depends on your dialogical skill, your tact, your timing, you know, and of course your warmth. So it tends to be received well if it seems that the therapist is closely tracking and listening. Then we have nonverbals. Now, there's a study, it's a famous study, but it's possible that someone here hasn't heard of it. It's what created this 7-38-55% rule. And what Albert Mehrabian was doing was trying to figure out what people actually depend on when they're getting conflicting information from somebody. So the idea is, if they're saying they're happy, but they obviously look like they're not, what are people paying attention to, you see? And so he designed studies for this. It led to this rule. So when trying to determine the actual emotion of another, 7% of the impression, he concluded, is conveyed through words. So now we have a training. We have psychologists like me being trained mostly in words and words about words, when in fact, if you're dealing with any kind of incongruence, ordinary people don't rely on that. 7% of the impression is conveyed through words, 38% through tone of voice, and 55% through facial expression. Well, these numbers are not, you know, on stone tablets, but these were the results of his, So the idea is, in theory then, we ought to be doing, a lot of our training ought to be focused on nonverbals, but mine wasn't. Word games. So what I'm getting at here is that a lot of therapy and even ordinary conversation can be about word games. There were some questions, you know, in the earlier this morning. And am I right or not? Tell me. Is there a proverb that says, A fool can ask more questions than seven wise men can answer. Does anybody know that proverb? Yes. Is that an Old Testament proverb, or does it come from someplace else? Well, I think sometimes people pride themselves, and I'm sorry to say it, Christians do, in asking questions that nobody can answer, right? That's a word game from my point of view. And if you saw my kind of nonverbal in that situation, I just said I'm not interested in that. Because at best, if you ask an unanswerable question, the best you're going to come up with is a half-truth. And if you insist on keeping asking that question, well, what can I say, right? It becomes a word game. One word game is thou shalt not name the obvious. So in other words, even though we're watching somebody who's saying that they're happy, but it's obvious that they're not, it's sort of become a matter of courtesy that we don't say it. We don't point out the incongruence. And in therapy, it's a delicate matter, right? How are you going to deal with the information that you have that the person seems not to want to acknowledge? Words function partly as a implicit command. So if somebody is saying something but it's not matching the rest, you might say it's an implicit command. They're telling you, pay attention to what I'm saying, you know, not what I'm revealing. So they can be distractions for people. You might say they're buried under their own word rubble. Beginning in childhood, many learn to inhibit vocal and non-vocal expressions of distress for their own sake. Studies of human crying show that basically it just tapers off rather quickly through the lifespan. And the people that study this say things that don't seem to me to be true about it, but seems true to me. Human tearing continues, but not vocal crying. Why? Because we learned not to do it. In many cultures, anyway, in my culture, there might be cultures where people wail quite openly. But, so now, what is a bad liar, I want to say? How exactly do we disguise ourselves? When we start learning to do that, how do we do it? I think we begin by disguising by means of our words. You know, did you eat that cookie? No. But if words are only 7% of the information that we're giving away, we might say, I'm still a bad liar, right? My mom can see right through me. So to be a good liar, we have to disguise our nonverbals. Oh, which means we need to do something physical now in order to be a better liar, which initially requires that we suppress these muscles. And so it's almost becomes an isometric exercise, you might say, to hold something in a way that's unnatural. I say here that to actually really pull this off, it helps to fool yourself. See? Then it becomes easier. The tension is resolved. So this is just a little something. I happen to be an etymology geek. So just to summarize this, even the concept of disguise takes a long time to develop as a word. It starts out as just an appearance, and it gradually becomes a fashion, and then finally, in 11th century in France, we have examples of it, somebody changing their appearance, like putting on a different costume, and finally it becomes to conceal an identity. It took a long time, maybe, for human beings to learn how to do this, is what I'm suggesting. So disguise to whom? How do we know when our guise is a disguise? I think it depends on when, developmentally, somebody did it. The earlier they did it, the harder it is for them to know it. Why? How long we've been doing it. I'm sorry to say that I've known a few people that only need to say a lie about 3 times before they believe it, right? But you have things like Stockholm syndrome, where probably it begins as pretend, and then, it isn't anymore. It depends on what we disguise. And a little bit more etymology I'll pass up. So here, I want to bring up the fourth voice. We have words, we have words about words, we have nonverbals, right? Then we have what I call the visceral or the fourth voice, suppression. So this is a central hypothesis that I'm following, that suppression becomes subpression. And I'll be explaining what that means. But if we want to not show something, there's a physical pushing down, pushing lower that occurs. It moves it further from the brain, it turns out. So, and I'll illustrate this as we go sort of downward. Suppression moves it also further from ordinary consciousness. Further, you might say, from the left brain processes, vocalization or verbalization. And prolonged suppression tends to convert emotion into musculoskeletal tension. This is why some early psychoanalysts got interested in character armor, because they would look at somebody and they'd say they were diagnosing them on sight. And so perpetual suppression tends to lead to fatigue, pain, emotional cycling, and illness. This is something that will be illustrated especially tomorrow. So we might start with where we first inhibit something. Let's say that I want to cry, as a child I want to cry, but I'm going to hold it. And sometimes you can physically see a child clench. When children are left in daycare, it's interesting, and a mother comes back to pick them up, I remember this with my own children, sometimes, this is so sickening if you've ever, I hope you haven't experienced it. So you pick up the child and they're stiff and they're not crying, but you know from talking to them that they were crying. They were crying for a couple of hours, right? But they've been fine since then. No, they quit crying, that's all that happened, right? And now their body is stiff, and you're trying to warm them back up. We have the English expression, biting one's tongue, but I actually think the jaw is normally more where the sensation is. This reaction can be fully conscious or unconscious. When it's no longer felt or sensed, then it tends towards somatization. Tension in the jaw is a musculoskeletal layer of interoception. So in other words, we're not yet talking about the viscera. So part of interoception is coming from our musculoskeletal system. It's not rare for this to be a presenting problem. And actually, if you look it up in the medical literature, it's interesting how many doctor's visits just have to do with jaw pain. And you might wonder how much of that we do to ourselves, right? More on that later. So this disorder, TMD, temporomandibular disorders, there's more than 30 of them. And so I do have it here. It may occur with headaches, back pain, sleep problems. There's all kinds of ways it presents. It often co-occurs with fibromyalgia and functional gastrointestinal disorders. Gastroenterologists, we talk about tomorrow, actually note that a lot of the patients that are coming in with gut disorder have TMJ. Okay, that's how good we are at suppressing, at burying. And that's why I call it a rescue operation. Counselors are rescuers. Resonant interoception. So what I'm asking here, and I want you to ask yourself now, but keep asking yourself, what is your own capacity to physically sense another's tension? Maybe, I don't know, one of the reasons I haven't spoken about it until now is I thought it was a freakish thing. I thought it was maybe just something that, and I finally decided, I don't think it is. I think other people can do this. They can pay attention to it, learn it. So now I'm going to describe listening with the throat. Now I'm talking about us as therapists listening here, not just with our here. When a person is choked up, I'm sure almost everybody here has been choked up. That's the English phrase, where the throat is tight with an emotion, and you're somewhat aware that that's what it is, but maybe you don't want to show it, or it's a situation where it doesn't belong. That's called the globus sensation. It used to be called globus hystericus, because, you know, everything psychological used to be related to the uterus. That's a joke. I hope it wasn't in bad taste. But it used to be called globus hystericus, but it's now referred to as the globus sensation or globus pharyngeus. But interoceptive resonance by the therapist is easiest to first, I'm telling you this, it's easiest, if you're learning this, to first learn it in the throat. And if you've watched, if you're like me, I'm a sap, and you watch movies, and you don't want to cry because you're in, you know, there, who's present watching with you, and you feel your throat tighten up, well, you've got the capacity. It happens to be a film instead of a person, but you can do it with a person, right? So interoceptive resonance is easiest to recognize here. I can be precise about it, but I don't think I need to because I think everybody is familiar with the sensation. I note here that inverse relationship between aging and vocal crying. So what's happening when you're feeling that in your throat is probably you've got an adult client in most cases, not a child, and they're choking something down. We say choked up because the pressure is up, but what we're really doing is choking down. We're sub-pressing. I say be prepared for this. If you want to do work this way as a counselor, get ready, because when it happens, it's like a solar eclipse. Okay, it's worse than that, because people are so good at suppressing, so practiced at it, that you've got about 10 seconds to act. And you've got to know ahead of time, how do I want to act? How do I want to put the pause button in a way on this, so that the person can become aware of it and so that it can become an emotional experience instead of a somatic one. So because there's this cycle. Note that it can be subconscious for a client. Sometimes they are aware of it, but they might not be. They might be so good at it that they're not listening to their own throat. Listening with the chest. Next to the throat, resonance, therapeutic resonance, our skill, is easiest to sense in the upper chest. Here, and you'll often see somebody. So when the client is aware of it, they might be doing this. But when they're not aware of it, you may be feeling it when they're not. And if you get there, then you're on your way. If you can get to that level, then you can get to these other levels. This sensation in the chest can be, it's also described in the medical literature. A lot of people go into emergency rooms with this because it can be that painful. It's about the size of a walnut or a golf ball, and it's down underneath the sternum here, and people will say to a doctor sometimes, I've got this chest pain, I need to have it evaluated, and they'll have an x-ray and EKG and all this. It's fine. In fact, when you look at the medical literature, it's almost always fine. It's non-cardiac chest pain, which is why the American College of Gastroenterology describes it the way that they do. And they note that there's some research here that's interesting. When they study it, they find out that if they even give mild cognitive stress to subjects and they're measuring local tightening, they can get that. It's measurable even in response to mild cognitive stress. So whether it's tracheal or bronchial or esophageal, you hear all sorts of things in the literature. And I personally think, yes, actually, it's regional. It's sort of all of those. and it's being registered by the vagus nerve, which is not particularly good at locating things. But we could say that chest pain seems a bit like you took the globus pharyngeus and you pushed it further down. It's almost the same size, you know, in sensation. That kind of golf ball here is felt a little larger and usually more painful. And you can have this occur, the sequence, with the same client, which is why I dare to do something that the medical literature doesn't. You could almost call this globus esophagus or globus trachealis, because it seems like it's a submerged globus pharyngeus. So it seems to me to represent both emotionally and physically a suppressing, in effect a swallowing or a pushing down, of the globus sensation, which was already a suppression. You see how we're getting layers in the first place. So put differently, we could say that the chest pain is the suppression of emotional expression. That's why people became psychodynamic psychotherapists, because people are so layered, because and things become unconscious. But different, transpersonal resonance. This is one way we could describe it. And I think I've described it enough, except I want to go to the third paragraph here. I'm describing why clients can be unaware of it. Well, in short, they're unaware because they want to be unaware. That's what they're doing. But remember that people may have been rewarded for shutting up. I've been out in public and seen a father slapping his boy around and telling him not to cry. And I'm thinking, oh, God, is my future client, you know? Or worse, right? Because I've worked in prison. The lump in the throat may long ago have become the knot in the chest, further from conscious associations. Don't expect them to know that they did it. If so, it's likely to become episodically anxiety-provoking. So in other words, there's upward pressure that they have to constantly have a defense against. Unlike this lump in the throat, which clients can sometimes explain, the knot in the chest is very often inexplicable. They have no idea where it's coming from, what it's associated with. Okay, expressive intervention. So we asked, I said, you better be ready if you want to do this. What are you ready to do? You're ready to try to help them express instead of suppress. There's 1,000 techniques, right? And you'll become good at some of them if you want to. But sometimes if they don't know what it is, a very good place to start is to just, I say leaving room for artistry, you can just ask a client what sound that pain might make, if it could make a sound. And if they were willing to do that, I said, I'll even do it with you. If you just give me a little sense, I'll do it for you. Okay, just give me a little sense of what sound you think it would make. A groan? Something like that. I've had clients, though, leave and say they're going to try to do it on their own. And they, you know where they tend to do it? Pardon? In their cars. They get out to the car and they're in traffic, and then they can do it. So heart. Now, we're moving here, because remember, we haven't even talked about an emotion yet. All we've talked about so far is the suppression, our reactions to our own emotions. But where's the emotion that wants to come up coming from? So it may help to address a semantic issue, because Eric Johnson does cardative therapy. Heart is used 800 times or something, you know, in the Bible. Lots of different meanings. It rarely refers to a pump in our chest. It almost always has a rather indistinct meaning that sometimes it refers to our fallenness, the hearts of men. transforming our hearts. I want to mention here, because it's important, there's 30 different words that are translated as heart in the Bible, so it gets very complicated if you want to go there. Christian psychologists, though, I think need we need a definition of heart that doesn't go to 30 different Hebrew and Greek words. Oh, and I want to mention, because tomorrow I get here, is that one of the Greek New Testament words that's translated as heart almost all the time is intestines. I want to get to why, you know, I think. But emotional breakthrough. So we have iconography, heart this, heart that, right? I send it to my wife all the time, you know, in the texts. And we have religious iconography that is the Sacred Heart of Jesus or Mary, who gives up her son, watches him die. And when clients present with this globus sensation in the throat, or even the pain here, they're very often, if you get movement, they will describe the heart. It happened to me yesterday talking to somebody. And what is interesting is that if somebody it's very often the case that if I just ask somebody, so would you just put your hand here, right? And just feel it for a moment. Spontaneous crying is rather common. It's interesting how little is holding it back at times, right? And if that happens, you know you're dealing with a fairly healthy client, actually, who's going to make quick change. What the remarkable thing is that if they're feeling this pain in the throat or in the chest, it's gone. As soon as they cry, it's gone. So it's so obvious. It becomes so obvious what it was, right? That it was suppression. So what's being released? Laughing and crying. And here I'm getting to the psychological definition of the heart. The base of the heart, I want to talk about it, the anatomy a little bit. The base of the heart, you may know, is fused with the diaphragm through the pericardium. So that it's rather strong, fibrous connection to the diaphragm. When we breathe and take a deep breath like we were in that exercise, we're actually giving our heart a little stretch. It's not just our lungs that are affected. Actually, the lungs do not have a fibrous connection with the diaphragm, but the heart does. With the lungs, it's a different, it's sort of a vacuum process. The emotions associated with the heart, I'm going to say, are partially imparted to it from below by the diaphragm. Why do I want to say that? Because when somebody lets go and has that breakthrough and they cry, it's their diaphragm that's moving. Now, there are sensations associated with it in the heart, but I almost want to say the diaphragmatic heart, right, is the psychological heart, because it's the one that can move in crying and in laughing. And so there's this expansion that can occur. It can be great. That's why people go to comedy clubs. You know, it's like a roller coaster. It feels great internally. You could say that every diaphragmatic action creates a passion. It's interesting that we use the word passions. So in other words, the heart is somewhat passive. The diaphragm is doing the movement. Gestures of the heart. Now I want to talk about what it feels like internally. Our heart is not doing all of these things, but there's a sense in which we feel it, which is odd. There's a spatial dynamic that's experienced in the heart. Expansion in joy. So it, people just say, you know, we say the Grinch who stole Christmas or something. Yeah. What happened at the end of it? His heart grew, you know, 10 times its size or something. That's the experience of joy. Now, is our heart really getting larger? No. But psychologically, yes. Shrinking or contracting of the heart when somebody's been pierced, hurt. I've had two sons who've been dumped by their first high school girlfriend. And it's almost like you could just see it. It's so sickening when you've been raising, you know, some sons to see this. Heartbreak, their first heartbreak, bowing. So what happens when we actually feel awe? There's almost a sensation. We might follow it with our body, right? The gestures that people do before kings may be just an act, but it's supposed to represent something that would naturally occur. Sinking in grief. This is described of Jesus. I think I quote it in the same psalm where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? My heart melts like wax into my bowels. Sinking. Seizing, that's the restriction of any of these things. So anxiety disorders, I see anxiety as a surface emotion in most cases, because what it really represents is that the person's effort not to have some other emotion. So they have an anxiety disorder and they want that to be the end of the matter. You think they want over that? Or they have obsessive compulsive disorder. So now they've dealt with the anxiety by their obsessions and their compulsions. You think they want you to help them with that so that they can get down to the thing that they've been trying to avoid? No. And release, peaceful release. There's a sense of just like any other muscle that we feel in the heart. So anesthesia, the numbing and the hardening of the heart. I'm saying, does that obsessive compulsive client want to help you help them? Well, I don't know. It requires all this emotional tolerance that they don't have yet. So the trick becomes, can I get them to tolerate that? For what I, when I'm working with obsessive compulsives, I try to negotiate 10 seconds of them tolerating whatever it is they would experience if they didn't do that, and just build from there. I want to build their capacity. Parents are the natural teachers of this kind of tolerance and support, but they're you know, our clients' parental environments are often lacking. So there's all sorts of ways to numb it, right? Perpetual distraction and hardening, so we can decide that we're going to be strong or callous. That's very tempting for men, because then some women really like these strong men, you know. I remember going out with somebody, a Christian gal, when I was young, and she told me, I talked to my sister about you. And my sister said, he sounds like a really nice guy. Is he too nice? That's it, right? Does he not have any toughness? Likely gender, culture, and individual differences. So there was a time in my life where I'd grown up this really gentle kid, and I thought, I need to layer it, you know, with some other stuff. Highly sensitive children may seem more likely to develop defenses. So that's the interesting thing. You can work with a child and they seem tough, and you're thinking, this is going to be a tough nut to crack. Or maybe they seem almost antisocial, right? And if you successfully work with that person, you've got a total marshmallow. You've got a hypersensitive person that started so early to try to deal with, cope with that, that it's a thick callus. Trinitarian theranostics is what I wanted to get here. This is a phrase I made up. It's a phenomenological approach to healing encounter. Theranostics is a medical term. It does exist. It's a new one. It combines the word diagnostic and therapeutic into certain elements of healing. And in nuclear medicine, where, for example, you're trying to target a cancer, difficult cancers like a pancreatic cancer that we know lots of people have died from pretty rapidly and the success rates are low, one of the things they're learning to do is that if they can identify a peptide that particular cancerous tissue tends to bond with much selectively, so more than normal tissue, then they can attach things to it that will either help them image where the cancer is in the entire body, has it metastasized and so on, and then they can put radioactive attachments to it so that now it selectively goes right to the cancer, binds to the cell. That's what they're trying to do. So the point is that it's both diagnostic and therapeutic. I'm applying this to psycho-spiritual healing. Theranostics here, I'm speaking of Christian psychology, refers to an I-thou encounter with the Godhead designed to target, image, and heal injury and sickness of soul. Now, this becomes more important the deeper you get. Because even when you get to the chest, you already have, you have something that the client can't explain. The deeper we go, the deeper something is suppressed, the more this theranostic approach can help. So, these are theranostic queries. Where do you locate yourself right now? And I asked you, I asked that in a little exercise the other day, because I want to know that. Where does a person, where is their center for them? They might say, it's up here. I'm always in my head. That's a very common response. I might ask, ask them, what is your greatest concern or hope at this moment? So now we know where they are and what they're hoping for. Those are two critical pieces of information. That tells us what they're ready, what they think they are ready to accept today. Then ask the client to picture the Father, Jesus, or the Spirit relative to their bodies. Where is the Father for you right now? Now, you may not ask all three, because with much more experience, you'll already have a hypothesis about which one of these is the one that you need to help you today. You might say it's the peptide, right? That's going to get you where you need to go. But for starters, I'll just say all three are possible. Where is the Father God for you right now? And there are associations with that that are not hard and fast rules. This is not gospel. This is just things that, these, see for yourself is what I would say if this does not turn out to be true. It doesn't have to be. But associations with authority figures and Father, safety, provision, Father being a provider, identity through, this is shifting, of course, as roles change, value and body. And there's some gender differences. I would say if I'm growing up as a girl, I really want for my dad to think I'm beautiful. Wow, what a gift that would be. Where is Jesus for you right now? And there are associations with peers and friends, with soul, and with beaus, boyfriends, mostly. Where's the Holy Spirit for you right now? Associations with mother figures, sisters sometimes that have been, often sisters raise people, muses, comfort and wisdom in the Old Testament with Sophia. Many people feel that Sophia in Proverbs is associated with the Holy Spirit. Whether it is or not, it's been historically viewed that way. So from pain to wound. Now, so what we are doing theranostically is trying to identify with a client the first wound associated with the pain. If we're now at that point, let's suppose they've expressed, they felt the pain here, they expressed, they cried, and we might ask, what's the first event in your life that you associate with that? With that, what just happened there? And then, here, see, now this is like the in nuclear medicine where now you attach the radioactive element, you know, to the peptide. So now we're asking, where is God, the Father, Son, or Spirit for you during that event that you just described to me? So now, what have we done? We brought God to that awakened memory, not one that somebody's telling us in their journalistic fashion, but they just experienced it emotionally. That's why it's important. Now, the timing is important. Don't bring it in when you know that a client hasn't felt anything. You know, they have their version of the trauma that they've told 100 people. No. Wait until there's connection. And then, where is God, you know, for you during this? It's pivotal that, in my view, that if there is such a thing as a truly Christian counseling or prayer ministry, that it doesn't happen without a person being able to find God there. So then the client, we direct the client to ask any questions that they may need to ask. In other words, have an encounter now. They're there emotionally, God is there, they get to interact with God there. Answers, wait for a response from God in any form. Make it very clear to clients, and God may speak to you in any way. I don't know what it'll be. Certainly not words, we're not trying to go back, you know, to the beginning. It might be words, but if it isn't, it's very important to be permissive about that, about anything that may come up. If there's no answer, return to the queries. And it's sometimes the case that now you've reached that client's limit. They did everything they could do today. It's very important to make that good. That was good. Not, you didn't get all the way there, you know. Because we want to build their capacity to go back, you know, to go back there, and they have to feel good about what they just did. If God is there, what would you like to let God do with that part? Now, some people who do this, yeah, if they're very focused on inner child, you know, kind of models, they will become more specific. You know, I prefer, unless you're absolutely committed to that internal family systems, you know, or inner child sort of work, to back a few steps away from that and let the client say what they need to happen, not, yes, I'd like for God the Father to carry that child away. Okay, does that work? Yes, sometimes it works. Okay, but don't get stuck in a mode like that. Let a client hear from God. We want this to be an encounter with God. Forgiveness. So I just want to introduce here that one of the things that I think Christian prayer ministries for certain do that is totally different from secular therapies is they actually think that forgiveness is an upfront task rather than the one that you're going to get to 10 years down the road. Now, you can either accept that or not, but there's no question that the scriptural basis for it is sound, you know. And I think what it is, now I worked with sex offenders in prisons, right? And so it's a hot topic in that area. I've also been a leader of a director of a sexual abuse treatment team in a medical center. So it's a hot topic in these areas. Do you ever ask somebody, expect them to forgive? But with Christian clients, the view here that I want you to consider is that they are captive until they do. You want it to be 10 years? You're going to be, are we doing them a favor that way? Because there's such a release for people. It's a curative, cleansing act. So to get sooner rather than later to this, are you willing? Now they're at this event. They're there with God who's forgiven them, right? Are you willing to forgive or leave them at the foot of the cross? Something. This is radical. But the reason why it's important is that for them is a saying yes to God, not to us, right? The God who is right there with them. If the client is not ready, absolutely it's okay. Absolutely. Where did I go? Forward or backward? Accept it. And just focus on the connection, because that's the most important thing of all. You know, I've tried to turn mind and body on their head, in a way. That's what I'm here to do. I traveled here to do this. And Christ in us, in our body, is whole and holy. That's what I read in the scripture. But our union with him is progressive, and our mind can go anywhere. Interoception, bodily awareness, is not only pivotal, but it provides a rendezvous, a real rendezvous with the Trinity. The body is designed to be theophanic, to be a vessel in which the Word becomes flesh for us. And so this is where I think that with our clients, the pressure is coming from. It's not only their own emotional pressure, but it's the God who wants to heal them. And we're facilitating this.